A Vindication of the Rights of Woman by Mary Wollstonecraft. First published in 1792. Second half of Chapter 5. Writers who have rendered women objects of pity bordering on contempt. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. I turn now to Dr. John Gregory, a Scottish physician, who wrote A Father's Legacy to His Daughters, for the benefit of his motherless daughters. His legacy to his daughters is full of such paternal care that I embark on the task of criticism with affectionate respect. But just because this little volume contains many things that might attract the most respect-worthy members of my sex, I can't silently let pass some arguments in it that seem to support opinions that I think have had the most harmful effect on the morals and manners of the female world. His easy, familiar style is particularly suited to the overall line of his advice, and the melancholy tenderness which, at his memory of a beloved wife, diffuses through the work, brings us onto its side. But our sympathy is disturbed by the concise elegance of many passages in the book, passages where, expecting to meet the father, we are suddenly confronted by the author. Another drawback is that he has two purposes, and doesn't often stay steadily with either of them. He wants to make his daughters lovable, but he doesn't want to give them sentiments that might make them unhappy by drawing them out of the track of common life, without giving them the means to manage this with independence and dignity. So, he checks the natural flow of his thoughts, and advises neither one thing nor the other. In the preface, he tells them a sad truth.
At least once in your lives, you will hear the genuine sentiments of a man who has nothing to gain from deceiving you.
Hapless woman, what can be expected from you when all the people you are said to depend on naturally for reason and support have something to gain from deceiving you? This is the root of the evil that has shed a corroding mildew on all your virtues. Blighting in the bud your opening faculties, it has made you the weak thing that you are. This divergence of interests, this difference between what brings gain to a male and what brings gain to a female, is an insidious state of warfare that undermines morality and divides mankind. If love has made some women wretched, how many more have been made vain and useless by the cold, unmeaning interplay of male gallantry? Yet this heartless attention of men to the female sex is regarded as so manly, so polished, that I'm afraid this vestige of Gothic manners won't be replaced by a more reasonable and affectionate mode of conduct until society is very differently organized. Also, to strip gallantry of its imaginary dignity, I should point out that in the most civilized European states, this lip service is most prevalent where morals are extremely dissolute. I'm thinking of Portugal, where gallantry takes the place of the most serious moral obligations, for in that country it seldom happens that a man is assassinated when he is in the company of a woman. The savage hand of murder is unnerved by this chivalrous spirit, and if the stroke of vengeance can't be delayed, the killer asks the lady to pardon the rudeness and to leave in peace, perhaps spattered with her husband's or brother's blood. Although many of Gregory's remarks about behaviour are very sensitive, I entirely disapprove of them all, because they strike me as starting at the wrong end, so to speak. A cultivated understanding and an affectionate heart won't have any need for starched rules of decorum. Without such rules, they will lead to something more substantial than conventional properness of behaviour. And on the other hand, obedience to such rules without understanding would be outright pretense. In Gregory's scheme of things, decorum is the one thing that is needed. Decorum is to supplant nature, and banish from the female world all simplicity and variety of character. But what good can come of this superficial advice? It is easier to list modes of behaviour that are required or forbidden than to set reason to work. But once the mind has been stored with useful knowledge and strengthened by being used, the regulation of the behaviour may safely be left to its guidance without the aid of formal rules. Consider, for example, this caution that Gregory gives to his daughters.
Be cautious, even in displaying your good sense. If you're not, you'll be seen as regarding yourself as superior to the rest of the company. And if you happen to have any learning, keep it a profound secret, especially from men, who generally look with a jealous and malignant eye on any woman who has knowledge, skill, and a cultivated understanding.
Why should that warning be given, when artfulness of every kind must contaminate the mind? And why entangle the grand motives of action, motives supported by reason and religion equally, with pitiful worldly devices and sleight-of-hand tricks to gain the applause of gaping, tasteless fools? If it were always proper to adopt the tone of the company one is in, there would be no end to rules for behaviour. With the key changing all the time in tune with the company, it would often happen that a flat was taken to be a natural note. Surely it would have been wiser to advise women to improve themselves until they rose above the fumes of vanity, and then let the public opinion come around to seeing them for what they are. The narrow path of truth and virtue doesn't veer to the right or the left. It is a straightforward business, and those who are earnestly travelling this road can leap across many prejudices without leaving modesty behind. Make the heart clean, and give the head work to do, and I predict that there will be nothing offensive in the behaviour. The air of fashion that many young people are so eager to achieve, fashion in clothes, manners, attitudes, and so on, always strikes me as being like the studied attitudes of some modern pictures, copied slavishly and tastelessly from ancient works of art. The soul is left out, and none of the parts are tied together by character, properly so called. This varnish of fashion may dazzle the weak, but leave nature to itself, unvarnished, and it will seldom disgust the wise. Besides, when a woman has enough sense not to pretend to anything that she doesn't understand in some degree, she has no need to hide her talents. Let things take their natural course, and all will be well. It is this system of pretense all through Dr. Gregory's book that I despise. Women are always to seem to be this and that, but virtue might speak in Hamlet's words,
"Seems? I know not seems. Have that within that passeth show."
In another place, after indiscriminately recommending delicacy, he adds,
"The men will complain of your reserve. They will assure you that a franker behaviour would make you more lovable. But trust me, they aren't sincere when they tell you that. I acknowledge that on some occasions a more open and forthright manner might make you more agreeable as companions, but it would make you less lovable as women. And that is an important distinction, which many of your sex are not aware of."
This desire to always be women is the very frame of mind that degrades the sex. It would, I repeat, be well if they were, except with a lover, only agreeable or rational companions. But in this respect, Gregory's advice is inconsistent with something else he says, which I now quote with strong approval.
"The view that a woman may allow men to engage in all innocent freedoms towards her, provided her virtue is secure, is both grossly indelicate and dangerous, and has proved fatal to many of your sex."
I agree with this. A man or woman of any feeling must always wish to convince a beloved object that what he or she is getting and returning with pleasure are caresses of the individual, not of the whole sex, and that the heart is moved rather than the senses. Without this natural delicacy, love becomes a selfish personal gratification that degrades the character. I take this view further. When love is out of the question, affection authorizes many personal endearments that flow naturally from an innocent heart and give life to the behavior. But the personal interplay of appetite, gallantry, or vanity is despicable. Suppose a man is helping a pretty woman into a carriage, a woman he doesn't know, and he squeezes her hand. If she has any true delicacy, she will regard this impertinent freedom as something like an insult, rather than being flattered by this meaningless homage to beauty. I would like to persuade my sex to act from simpler principles. Let them merit love, and they will obtain it, though they may never be told that. I like Dr. Gregory's remark, "The power of a fine woman over the hearts of very able men is beyond what she conceives." I have already remarked on the narrow cautions Gregory offers relating to deceit, female softness, delicacy of constitution, for these are the themes that he keeps endlessly coming back to. He handles them in a more decorous manner than Rousseau does, but basically he agrees with Rousseau on these matters, and if you take the trouble to analyse these opinions of Gregory's, you will find that their first principles are not quite so delicate as the superstructure. You'll see in due course that my views about friendship, love, and marriage are non-trivially different from Gregory's. I don't want to get ahead of myself and talk about that now, important as it is. I want here merely to remark on the overall spirit of Gregory's treatment of them, on his cautious family prudence, on his limited views of partial, unenlightened affection. These views exclude pleasure and improvement, by vainly wanting to fend off sorrow and error, and destroy all the energy of heart and mind by thus guarding them. It is far better to be often deceived than never to trust, to be disappointed in love than never to love, to lose a husband's fondness than forfeit his esteem. It would be a good thing for the world, and for individuals, of course, if all this useless care to attain a limited and limiting worldly happiness were turned into an anxious desire to improve the understanding. Two quotations from the Book of Proverbs. "Wisdom is the principal thing, therefore get wisdom, and with all thy gettings get understanding." And, "How long, ye simple ones, will ye love simplicity and hate knowledge?" That is wisdom speaking to the daughters of men. I shan't mention all the writers who have written on the subject of female manners. It would, in fact, be only beating over the old ground, for they have in general said the same things. But I'm on the attack against man's iron scepter of tyranny, and I declare against all power built on prejudices, however ancient. If women's submission is to be based on justice, that is the highest court of appeal, for God is justice itself. So let us, as children of the same parent, reason together, and learn to submit to the authority of reason when its voice is distinctly heard. And if it is proved that this throne of prerogative rests on nothing but a chaotic mass of prejudices that aren't kept together by any inherent principle of order, anyone who escapes from it, braving the consequences, will not be guilty of a breach of duty, will not be sinning against the order of things. The being who can govern him or herself has nothing to fear in life. But if anything is dearer to someone than his or her own respect, the price for that must be paid to the last farthing. Virtue, like everything valuable, must be loved for itself alone, or it won't come to live with us. It won't impart the peace which passeth understanding, if it is used merely as the stilts of reputation, and respected with pharisaical exactness, because honesty is the best policy. It can't be denied, and it never is denied, that the plan of life that enables us to carry some knowledge and virtue into the afterlife is a plan with the best chance to ensure contentment in this life. Yet few people act according to this principle. This sober conviction is swept aside by present pleasure or present power. How few, how very few, have enough foresight or resolution to endure a small evil at the moment so as to avoid a greater evil hereafter. Woman in particular, whose virtue is built on changeable prejudices, seldom attains to this greatness of mind, so that she becomes the slave of her own feelings, and is thus easily subjugated by the feelings of others. When her reason, her misty reason, is thus degraded, it is employed in polishing her chains rather than breaking them. I have indignantly heard women argue along the same lines as men, and adopt the sentiments that treat them as animals, doing this with all the stubborn persistence of ignorance. One woman, who conspicuously does not do this, is Catherine Macaulay, who is certainly the woman of the greatest abilities that this country has ever produced. She has been allowed to die without sufficient respect being paid to her memory, but posterity will be more just, and will remember that Catherine Macaulay was an example of intellectual acquirements supposedly incompatible with the weakness of her sex. No sex appears in her style of writing, for it is like the sense it conveys, strong and clear. I won't say that she has a masculine understanding, because I don't accept that there is anything masculine about reason, but I contend that her understanding was sound, and that her judgment, the mature fruit of profound thinking, was a proof that woman can acquire judgment in the full extent of that word. She writes with sober energy and tightness of argument, yet her sympathy and benevolence draw us to her side, and give her arguments the vital heat that forces the reader to weigh them. When I first thought of writing the present work, I anticipated Mrs. Macaulay's approval, with a little of the hopeful eagerness that it has been the business of my life to suppress. Then I heard that she had died. Hearing this with a sickly spasm of disappointed hope and the steady seriousness of regret. Lord Chesterfield's letters to his son must not be silently passed over. Not that I mean to analyse his unmanly, immoral system, or even to select any of the useful shrewd remarks that occur in his letters. No, all I intend to offer are a few thoughts about the purpose that the author says the letters have, namely, the art of acquiring an early knowledge of the world. This is an art that preys secretly, like the worm in the bud, on the young person's expanding powers, and turns to poison the abundant juices that should mount with vigour in the youthful frame, inspiring warm affections and great resolves. For everything there is a season, says the wise man Ecclesiastes. And who would look for the fruits of autumn during the genial months of spring? But this is mere rhetoric on my part, and I mean to reason with those worldly wise instructors who, instead of cultivating the young person's judgment, instill prejudices and harden the heart that gradual experience would only have cooled. An early confrontation with human infirmities, what is called knowledge of the world, is, in my view, the surest way to shrink the heart and dampen the natural youthful ardour which produces not only great talents, but also great virtues. The vain attempt to bring forth the fruit of experience, when the sapling has not yet come into leaf, only exhausts its strength, and prevents it from taking on a natural form. Tell me, you who have studied the human mind, isn't it a strange way to fix principles by showing young people that principles are seldom stable? And how can they be strengthened by habits when they are shown examples in which the habits work out badly? Why is the ardour of youth thus to be damped, and the luxuriance of imagination cut right back? It's true that this dry caution about how badly people sometimes behave may guard a character from the worldly mischances, but it certainly will rule out excellence in virtue and in knowledge. The stumbling block thrown across every path by suspicion will prevent any vigorous exertions of genius or benevolence, and life will be stripped of its most alluring charm long before its calm evening. A young man who has grown up in a family who are his friends, and has stored his mind with as much theoretical knowledge as can be acquired by reading and the natural reflections that youthful outbursts of animal spirits and instinctive feelings inspire, will enter the world with warm and erroneous expectations. But this seems to be the course of nature, and in morals, as well as in works of taste, we should go in the direction nature points out to us, and not presume to lead when we ought humbly to follow. Few people act from principle. Actions are primarily triggered by present feelings and early habits, but the feelings would be deadened, and the habits turned into rusting fetters if young people were shown the world just as it is. What will make them uncensorious and forgiving is the knowledge of mankind and of their own hearts that can be slowly obtained through experience. If they have that, they will see their fellow creatures as frail beings, like themselves, condemned to struggle with human infirmities, sometimes displaying the light side of their character and sometimes the dark, giving rise to alternate feelings of love and disgust. But when they are guarded against their fellow creatures as though they were beasts of prey, every enlarged social feeling is eradicated, i.e., their humanity is eradicated. In life, on the other hand, as we gradually discover the imperfections of our own nature, we also discover virtues. And various circumstances attach us to our fellow creatures when we mix with them and view the same objects, circumstances that are never thought of by someone acquiring a hasty, unnatural knowledge of the world, such as Lord Chesterfield tries to provide. We see a folly swell into a vice by almost imperceptible degrees, and we pity the person while we also blame him or her. But if the hideous monster, the vice, came suddenly into view, our fear and disgust would make us more severe than man ought to be, and might lead us in our blind zeal to put ourselves in God's place and pronounce damnation on our fellow mortals, forgetting that we can't read their hearts, and that we have seeds of the same vices lurking in our own. We expect more from instruction, I repeat, than mere instruction can produce. Instead of preparing young people to confront life's evils with dignity, and to acquire wisdom and virtue through the use of their own faculties, precepts are heaped on precepts, and blind obedience to them is required, when conviction should arise from the use of reason. Suppose, for instance, that a young person in the first ardour of friendship deifies the beloved object, regarding him or her as a god. What harm can arise from this mistaken enthusiastic attachment? It may indeed be better than merely harmless, because it may be necessary for virtue to appear first in a human form to impress youthful hearts. The ideal model, which a more mature and elevated mind looks up to and shapes for itself, would elude their sight. He who loves not his brother, whom he hath seen, how can he love God? Asked the wisest of men. Our trees are now allowed to spread with wild luxuriance, and we don't expect by force to combine the majesty of the mature tree with the graces of the young sapling. Rather, we wait patiently until the trees have driven their roots down deep and braved many a storm. Well, then, is the mind to be treated with less respect? To argue from analogy, everything around us is in a progressive state, and when an unwelcome knowledge of life gives us a sense of having had almost enough of life, and we discover by the natural course of things that everything that happens under the sun is vanity, we are drawing near to the awe-inspiring close of the drama. The days of activity and hope are over, and as for the opportunities that our early years gave us for advancing in the scale of intelligence, we have nearly reached their bottom line. A knowledge of the futility of life is very useful at this period, or earlier, if it is obtained through experience. Useful because it is natural. But when a frail, young, inexperienced being is shown the follies and vices of man so as to teach him to guard prudently against the common casualties of life by sacrificing his heart, that's the wisdom of this world, contrasted with the nobler fruit of piety and experience. I will venture a paradox. If men were born only to form a circle of life and death, it would be wise to take every possible step to make life happy. Moderation in every pursuit would then be supreme wisdom, and a sexually energetic person who took care of his own interests could enjoy a degree of contentment, although he didn't cultivate his understanding or keep his heart pure. If we were mortal, prudence would be true wisdom. Or, to put the point more explicitly, prudence would yield the greatest portion of happiness, considering the whole of life. But knowledge about anything other than the conveniences of life would be a curse, or at any rate, the pursuit of it would be a curse, as I now proceed to explain. Why should we injure our health by close study? The exalted pleasure that intellectual pursuits provide would hardly compensate for the hours of exhaustion that follow, especially if we take into account the doubts and disappointments that cloud our researches. Every inquiry ends with empty hands and annoyance, because the cause that we particularly wanted to discover recedes before us as we advance, like the horizon. Yet, disappointed as we are in our researches, the mind is strengthened through exercise, perhaps becoming strong enough to grasp the answers that it may receive in the afterlife, answer to the anxious questions it asked in this life, when the understanding was fluttering around the visible effects and hoping to dive into the hidden cause. The passions, which are the winds of life, would also be useless or even harmful if the substance that composes our thinking being were to die with our bodies. The appetites would meet all our earthly needs and would produce more moderate and permanent happiness than our passions do. But the powers of the soul, that are of little use in this life, and probably disturb our animal pleasures, prove that this life is merely an education, a state of infancy, which should not be allowed to extinguish the only hopes worth cherishing. The conclusion I draw from this is that we ought to have a precise idea of what we want to attain by education. The immortality of the soul is contradicted by the educational activities of many people who firmly announce that they believe in it. If what you primarily want for your child is ease and prosperity on earth, leaving the afterlife to provide for itself, then you are acting prudently in giving your child an early insight into the weaknesses of human nature. You may not turn him into a vicious scoundrel, but, after taking in at a very early age a view of human nature as very low down, he will never do better than sticking to the letter of the law, and will not think he needs to rise much above the common standard. He may avoid gross vices, because honesty is the best policy, but he will never aim at attaining great virtues. The example of writers and artists will illustrate this remark. It is always wise to regulate one's passions. This has been thought to be an axiom in morals, but I think it is a dogmatic assertion made by men who have coolly seen mankind through the medium of books, and I don't believe it. I say in direct contradiction to it that the regulation of the passions is not always wisdom. On the contrary, one reason why men have better judgment and more endurance than women is that they give a freer scope to the grand passions, and by more frequently going astray, they enlarge their minds. If, then, their use of their own reason leads them to settle on some stable principle, they have probably to thank the force of their passions, nourished by false views of life, and permitted to jump across the boundary that guarantees contentment. If at the start of life we could soberly survey the scenes before us, and see everything in its true colours, how could the passions get enough strength to help the faculties to develop? Let me now, as from a mountain top, survey the world stripped of its false delusive charms. The clear atmosphere lets me see each object in its true point of view, and I have no passions. Refreshed by rest, I am as calm as the prospect on a morning when the mists are slowly dispersing and silently unveiling the beauties of nature. What will the world look like now? I rub my eyes and think, perhaps, that I am just awaking from a lively dream. I see the sons and daughters of men pursuing shadows and anxiously squandering their powers to feed passions that have no adequate object. I descend from my mountain top, and mixing with my fellow creatures, I feel myself being hurried along the common stream. Ambition, love, hope, and fear exert their usual power, although we are convinced by reason that their present and most attractive promises are only lying dreams. But if the cold hand of circumspection had damped each warm feeling before it had left any permanent mark or fixed some habit, what could be expected other than selfish prudence and reason barely rising above instinct? Anyone who has read with a philosophical eye Dean Swift's disgusting description of the Yahoos and his insipid account of the Wynnums, must see the futility of degrading the passions, or making man settle for being merely contented. The youth should act. If he had the experience of a grey-head, he would be fitter for death than life. His virtues, residing in his head rather than his heart, could produce nothing great, and his understanding, prepared for this world, wouldn't embark on noble flights, showing that it had a right to a better world. Besides, you can't give a young person a just view of life. Before he can estimate the force of the temptation that led his brother into vice, he must have struggled with his own passions. Those who are entering life, and those who are departing from it, see the world from such very different points of view that they can seldom think alike. When we hear of some daring crime, it comes full upon us as darkly wicked, and arouses our indignation. But the eye that saw the darkness gradually thicken, seeing the mental processes that led to the crime, must observe it with more compassionate forbearance. The world can't be seen by an unmoved spectator. We must mix in the throng, and feel as men feel, before we can judge of their feelings. In short, if we mean to live in the world in order to grow wiser and better, and not merely to enjoy the good things of life, we must acquire a knowledge of others at the same time that we become acquainted with ourselves. Knowledge acquired any other way only hardens the heart and puzzles the understanding. I may be told that knowledge acquired in this way is sometimes purchased at too high a price. I can only answer that I very much doubt whether any knowledge can be acquired without labour and sorrow, and those who wish to spare their children both shouldn't complain if they are neither wise nor virtuous. All the parents aimed at was to make their children prudent, and prudence, early in life, is simply the cautious craft of ignorant self-love. I have noticed that young people who have received a particularly attentive education have usually been very superficial and conceited, and far from pleasing in any respect, that is because they had neither the unsuspecting warmth of youth nor the cool depth of age. I can't help thinking that the main cause of this unnatural condition is the hasty, premature instruction that leads them to repeat, confidently, all the crude notions they have taken on trust, so that the careful education they have been given makes them lifelong slaves of prejudices. The senses and the imagination give a form to the character during childhood and youth, and in later years the understanding gives firmness to what sensibility has provided, until virtue, arising from the clear conviction of reason rather than the impulse of the heart, creates a morality that stands on a rock against which the storms of passion beat in vain. I hope I shan't be misunderstood when I say that religion won't have this condensing energy unless it is based on reason. If it is merely the refuge of weakness or wild fanaticism, and not a governing principle of conduct drawn from self-knowledge and a rational belief about the attributes of God, what can it be expected to produce? The religion that consists in warming the affections and exalting the imagination is only the poetic part of religion. It may give pleasure to the individual, but it won't make him or her a more moral being. It may be a substitute for worldly pursuits, but it is no good, because it narrows the heart instead of enlarging it. If any great degree of excellence is to be expected, virtue must be loved as something inherently sublime and excellent, and not for the advantages it brings or the evils it averts. Men will not become moral when they only build airy castles in a future world to compensate for the disappointments that they meet with in this world, turning their thoughts from relative duties to religious daydreams. Most prospects in life are harmed by the shuffling worldly wisdom of men who try to blend contradictory things, forgetting that they can't serve God and Mammon. If you want to make your son rich, pursue one course. If all you care about is making him virtuous, you must take another. But don't imagine that you can jump across from one road to the other without losing your way. End of chapter 5.